I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, Ken Burns takes on country music.
I believe that you can go look and find a country song to fit any mood you're in.
We'll spend this hour with producer Julie Dunphy and writer-producer Dayton Duncan talking about the 16-hour documentary series that premieres September 15th and the surprising discoveries they made about this uniquely American form of expression. Our conversation starts after a short break. That country music is about pickup trucks and good old dogs and two-timing spouses. And that's not entirely wrong because, as Dolly Parton explains it, country music tells stories about life in America.
You can dance to it. You can cry to it. You can make love to it. You can play it at a funeral. It's just really has something in it for everybody, and people relate to it.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If you already love country music, you have probably made a date to watch the 16-hour documentary series by Ken Burns Production Company. If you don't consider yourself a fan of the genre, you might be surprised at the extraordinary history of its evolution, with inspiration drawn from the British Isles and Africa, and American jazz clubs, churches, parlors, and porches. Writer-producer Dayton Duncan and producer Julie Dunphy are the creative team behind the 8-part documentary series Country Music. It premieres September 15th on PBS. Dayton and Julie, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So the series Jazz made the case that jazz was the only true American art form. Where does that leave country music?
Well, it means that someone needed to talk to Ken earlier before he did his jazz series. I think what he would say if he were here, too, is that jazz and country music come from the same place. Mm. They come from America, where it's been this mix and mingle of the fiddle from the British Isles meets with the ballads and hymns from there, meets a music that came over on a slave ship with impressed people who then fashioned a gourd like they had done in Africa and put a fretless neck to it and created a banjo. And those, in the most simplistic terms, when those two things met, and they met here in America, that set off a chain reaction that has affected all of American music and reverberates through it. So the blues, jazz, country music, pop music, rock and roll, all come from that that space. And they are both uniquely American art forms.
What makes country music so perfectly suited to telling stories?
Well, country music is a lyric-driven music. Mm-hmm. And that was actually one of the great challenges for us going in, because it's a perfect, often simple melodies. The songwriter Harlan Howard said country music is three chords in the truth, but it's that kind of simple melody married to beautiful, beautiful poetry. It's telling a story, and that makes it uniquely suited to what we do, which is telling stories as well.
And just to follow up on that, the challenge then is in telling our story about the history of this art form, which itself is storytelling to music, is trying to make sure that we can let the songs, have some space so that they can tell their stories. So we tell the stories of the incredible artist, Dolly, mm-hmm. Couple of dozen Texans, who have these remarkable lives and were remarkable artists. But the reason we tell their story is to get us to the music, which itself oftentimes is a story. And so we'll tell the story behind the person who made it. We'll tell the story behind how that song got written. And we also try to let the song have as much time as it can to tell its own story and stand on its own.
Did I read that there are 600-plus pieces of music in this film?
Well, if we're being precise, 584 music cues.
So, I mean, I've done just a little bit of work in the documentary space, and getting permission to do anything is really challenging when someone else owns the rights to the song. So tell us about that process.
It was a monumental task. We had a terrific team doing it, but as you may know, you need to secure all sorts of rights. You need to secure publishing rights for the person who wrote the song. You need to secure recording rights for the person who sang and recorded it. And oftentimes, if there's been, say, more than one marriage on either, those rights might then be divided up in different. So it was a monumental task to chase down and make sure that every artist was getting their due. But we did it over a couple of years. We tried to be quite methodical about it, and we think, you know, we got it right.
Yeah, it was much more enormous than any film we've ever done. Music's always important to our storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, Lewis and Clark, which I wrote and produced with Ken, we had great music on it, but it's, you know, we got some musicians together in a small studio in Vermont and had them play these, you know, old traditional songs that were either from the period or maybe not necessarily from the period, but, you know, they were instrumental. If you're telling the story of Waylon Jennings and his sort of call to arms in the 1970s about, are you sure Hank done it this way? You don't want to use fiddle music that you recorded in a studio in Vermont. You want to hear Hank singing it. You don't want to hear anybody else singing it. You want to hear Hank singing it. And so that was a great, not great challenge. It was, you know, we looked at it as a great blessing that we were able to, you know, to actually bring to people those artists and their versions of the song to animate our film.
And we knew that going in that music rights would be a much larger percentage of our overall budget than it had been on any other film. So we tried to anticipate that.
Was there
I knew that Julie was going to be doing all the work, and so I could just say, "Oh, we should be hearing this song too." And what about this one?
Tell Julie to add it to the tab.
Right. Just let Julie take care of it.
Was there anything that you were holding out on until very close to the time that you closed the film?
We had great cooperation from the country music family, both, you know, the artists and on the whole, the industry itself. There was a couple of ones we were, you know, doing the closing down on the securing the rights after we had, quote, locked the film, that we ran into some potential obstacles that we thought, oh, my God, what do we do if we can't actually use this song?
We lost little bit of sleep.
We lost a lot of sleep. I'm not going to name any names. It all ultimately worked out for us, but I had hair at the start of the project and I don't have any anymore.
There are fewer historians in this film than previous films that the company has done. What really amazed me is hearing how much of this history that many country artists know. They know it like historians.
That's a very astute observation. We interviewed 101 people on camera. We talked to a lot more than that, but we interviewed 101. And of that number, only one is a historian. And when we started the project, that wasn't necessarily our anticipation. We had a long list of people, but one person that we knew that we were going to interview was the Bill Malone, whose book, Music City USA, 50 years ago, was a path-breaking academic look at this art form. No one else had ever done it, and it was viewed with a little bit of disdain by the academic community. How can you be talking about, you know, it's country music after all? I mean, how can you be serious about it? That kind of stuff. But as we started first with the older artists that we wanted to do because they were older. And so our first interview was with Little Jimmy Dickens, now dead. Our second interview that same day was with Harold Bradley, great session musician from Nashville, now dead. Our third interview was with Roy Clark, multi-talented, multi-instrumentalist, singer, comedian, now dead. And of the 101 people we interviewed, 20 are now dead. But what we learned is they what they brought to it is not only a deep knowledge of the history of their art form. They could talk about things beyond themselves. You know, in certain instances, Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, some others, they were more interested in talking about their heroes or heroines than they were about themselves. Because, you know, you think of their career, most of the time they're just being asked questions endlessly about, you know, their own lives. And the chance to talk about, for Willie to talk about Ernest Tubb, you know, that's what he wanted to talk. Merle Haggard wanted to talk about Jimmy Rogers or Bob Wills. He loved to talk about Bob Wills. And so when we'd finally get to their stories, they'd opened up also a little bit more. But we realized that they were playing the role, as long as they were accurate, you know, they were playing the role that historians would play normally for us. But they gave it a little different, I don't know, for me, it gave it a little different flavor because they come to it as musicians themselves.
I would characterize it as an intimacy. Almost, yeah. That it brought to the history.
I like the description of the film of Bob Wills strutting around on stage like Elvis or Mick Jagger. For people who maybe haven't seen video, can you talk about what those performances look like?
Those performances are really fun. You know, it's always fun in this particular project to track down archival footage. Mm-hmm. So you could see what some of these, you know, people may be familiar with Bob Wills, but there's not a whole lot of footage of him. So to actually see him strutting around the stage and sweating and doing his thing as, you know, somebody's talking about what he was like was really really, it's really fun, I think, to see in the film. And we have a great team of people who track down stills and footage for us. And that was one of the other monumental tasks was to find these performances, see what was out there and work with folks and bring it to life. Some of it's just footage, it's not sound. So we would often have to marry it with the sound we had. And I think our editors did a great job of bringing those folks to life from the 30s and 40s further back.
So this is Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys in 1944 with San Antonio Rose.
It was there I found beside the apple enchantment strange as a blue up above.
I hear you, my boy.
The paths that only she would know still hears my broken song of love.
There's a whole complicated story surrounding this song.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a great one to choose because it proves or illuminates some of the larger points that I think come through in our film. So Bob Wills, born in Texas. Neighbors were black sharecroppers, learned some blues from them. His dad was and his uncle and his grandfather were all, you know, champion fiddlers in Texas. They moved to the Panhandle. He becomes a accomplished fiddler himself, moves to New Mexico, plays with a band with Hispanic musicians for a while, comes back to Fort Worth, where jazz is broken forth, and he's captivated by it. It's all, he's hearing all these different, you know, music that is going, but he's a fiddler. And so he wants to play something similar to the big band sound, but focusing on a fiddle and a steel guitar versus horns necessarily. And so you can just feel this rich thing probably going on. And we couldn't interview him, obviously, but we had Merle Haggard wanted to talk about him. Ray Benson was a great interview about him. But he's got all those things going on. He had a song called Spanish Two-Step that he then used as the basis for an instrumental version of what he called San Antonio Rose. And it was a popular dance song here in the Southwest. The Irving Berlin Company in New York said, whoa, this is pretty successful. Why don't you let us write some words to that and rearrange it a little bit? So he said, oh, you know, okay, why don't you give it a try? He got it back, and he just hated it because the words, you know, didn't make sense to him, and the arrangement didn't make sense, and the audiences didn't like it. So he gave one of his horn players a jug of whiskey and said, write some words. And the guy wrote the wonderful words there. He comes out with that, and it's a huge smash, and then it gets picked up by Bing Crosby and sells millions of records. So you think about those different Hispanic, African-American, jazz, Southwestern fiddle, then Bing Crosby, and that tells you the whole story of American music and country music and how broad its roots and embrace are.
My guests are writer-producer Dayton Duncan and producer Julie Dunphy of the 8-part documentary series Country Music. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
But she never complains of the bad times or the bad things he's done. She just talks about the good times they've had and all the good times to come. She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good time man.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was Good Hearted Woman from 1976. My guests this hour are writer-producer Dayton Duncan and producer Julie Dunphy of the 8-part PBS documentary series Country Music, a film by Ken Burns. It starts on September 15th. How did outlaw country become a thing?
Well, the two people were two Texans who are primarily responsible for it, Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson. And Waylon was doing well in a honky-tonk in Arizona, and he got heard by somebody and said, "My God, you've got a great voice and a great sound. Why don't you come to Nashville?" He asked his friend Willie Nelson whether that was a good idea, and Willie told him, "Don't do it. They'll just break your heart." He went anyway. Willie had already had a career in Nashville where his songs that he wrote, Crazy, Nightlife, Half a Man, others had done well for other artists, but they just couldn't quite get him into the what was their star machinery, right? Because you just listen to that, his guitar, Trigger, he's playing, his two musical influences and heroes were Ernest Tubb and the jazz guitarist Django Reinhardt. And that fusion, made his guitar playing quirkier, his phrasing, his singing different, and they just couldn't mold him into what they thought he needed to be. And he got frustrated and came back to Texas. And here in Texas, he found an audience of combination of redneck truck drivers and hippie, long-haired hippie kids in Austin who really, understood what he was trying to do. Waylon, meanwhile, they're having the same problem trying to mold him into a sort of Nashville sound type singer. And he finally just said, "I'm not doing this. I'm going to do this my way." And he broke all of the rules and got a new contract that allowed him to choose to bring his own band into the studio instead of just session musicians. It allowed him to record in studios other than his record label studio. And he had a friend, Tom Paul Glazer, where he could record all night if he wished to, and he would be in control of what he sang. And he had this great song called "Are You Sure Hank Done It This Way," which is the title of our seventh episode, which is, things have got to change. And, Nashville didn't know quite what to make of either of them until their records started selling like hotcakes. And then as Waylon said, suddenly we didn't need Nashville anymore. They needed us. And Julia can probably tell you how the term outlaw came, but she did the interview with the woman who gave it the name. Would you like that?
That might be my favorite interview. So please tell us that story.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking about Hazel Smith, who was a revelation to us for sure. And I had the pleasure of doing that interview. And Hazel is in the latter part of her life as a writer, but at the time she was at Glazer's recording studio and she was the manager there. And she tells incredible stories about coming into work and finding people asleep on her desk and trying to move them off and say, "Don't ever do that again." But of course they would be sleeping on her desk the next morning. But as she says in her interview and in the film, she felt like everything needed a name. And as she recounts, she was sitting at her desk and she opened the dictionary and she came to the definition of outlaw. And she read and she read, and the last line, she finally said, living outside the written law. And she thought about it, and she said, that's what they're doing. They've redefined how they're making and recording their music. They're doing it outside the Nashville way. And she says, so you can tell people that's how we got the name Outlaw, and you talk to the woman who named it.
And the producer there had the great idea to take an old Western wanted poster and created this notion using material that Willie Waylon, Waylon's wife Jesse Coulter, and Tom Paul Glazer had already recorded that they had in their vaults, and to make it under this thing called Wanted the Outlaws. And it became the first country record to sell to go platinum, to sell a million records, and then it sold a million more. And you know, it's an interesting thing, and part of what that teaches you too, and that's part of our series, I think, is there's commerce and art, and sometimes the commerce is helping the art get exposed and reach more people, and sometimes the commerce is kind of putting a damper on the art. But good art, and country music at its best, is exquisite, I think, art. If it's released, it will find its way. And the same thing with Willie had done the same thing with an album called Redheaded Stranger, which the label did not want to release. They said it sounded like a bad demo because he'd done it in a Dallas studio and tried not to overspend on it. And overproduce it. He didn't like all the gewgaws that was happening with music at that time. So it was just him and his guitar basically singing these songs. And they said, well, we'll let him do it and we'll just humor him and do it. It'll crash and then he'll do whatever we tell him to do. And of course, just the opposite. It was a huge success.
I know this is about the music and the sound, but the physical transformation of Willie and Waylon is extraordinary. Like I, my husband watched with me, and I said he's unrecognizable, even though we all know that they both started out, you know, looking very different and trying to look like Nashville wanted them to look.
Yeah, you can look at and we go back to their childhood, and you look at the young Willie Nelson, and actually you can see him there, right? And the harder one actually is when he's an adult and you see him in a slick suit and a narrow tie and his hair's kind of slicked back. And
he's like one of the limelighters.
Yeah, exactly. And Waylon, I mean, really handsome guy. But when he's, you know, clean cut and others, he's just not what you're expecting until they both, you know, during the outlaw things, just decided they're going their own way. And, of course, that was at a time in American cultural history when that was also happening to many people, not to many people their age. When Willie Nelson came back to Texas and started singing at the Armadillo World headquarters, he was a generation older than his fans and a generation older, usually, of many of the musicians there. But they loved him, and he loved them back. And he called Waylon and said, there's something going on down here. You got to come down. And Waylon just loved it as well.
That transformation that you see in the film, particularly with Willie, was really fun for our stills researchers and our editors to put together. I mean, they knew they had to find each stage as you see the hair getting longer and longer, and sometimes you see the beard growing and the different. They really had fun with that, putting that together.
Somebody else that nobody expected before, suddenly it seemed like he should have been there all along, was Charlie Pride. Talk a little bit about his evolution. He was like from this huge family, right? A family of sharecroppers.
Yep.
Didn't want to grow up and pick cotton.
Yeah, his dream was, you know, and this is true of so many of the great country artists of that part of that time period of the early and mid-20th century, so many of them came from abject poverty. And their dream was to do something other than pick cotton or do whatever their parents and their condition were. And for them, music turned out to be a way out. For him, it's interesting, particularly since, you know, Ken had done a history of baseball. For him, a significant moment was when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in the National League, and he thought, maybe that's my way out. And for a while, he played as a pitcher for the in the Negro League in Memphis, and later was on a minor league team, got discovered there, singing at night. He would sing in the bars in Helena, Montana, of all places, and he was singing a Hank Williams song. And two Opry stars came by and said, my God, this guy's got a voice. And said, sometime if this baseball thing doesn't work out, he should come to Nashville. And the baseball thing didn't work out, and he went to Nashville. And, you know, it took place in the mid-60s, and the things that he faced in discrimination and prejudice were enormous. But his talent was such that it just finally overwhelmed any prejudice people might have had as a black country singer. And again, there was an artist, Farron Young, who became his friend, a white guy, a great singer, who stuck up for him, and they became good friends. And that is this, you know, sort of healing story of the of what Charlie faced. But he was a terrific, terrific interview. Very open about things, about the things that he faced. You know, the first time he did a concert, well, his record company, when his first records were coming out, they didn't bother attaching any photographs or mention to the DJs that this fellow was an African American.
Oh, so like let the audience think he's white.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what they thought. Yeah, and his voice was such that I think people would say, well, that's just a great country voice, and not attach any race to it, you know, which they shouldn't anyway. His first big concert was up in Detroit, and both he and the fellow who was the MC of it helped tell the story. He gets a big build-up and said, you know, please welcome from Sledge, Mississippi, Country Charlie Pride. They'd already heard some of his records, the crowd going wild. He walked on the stage, and then they said you could hear a pin drop. It just stopped. They were just gobsmacked. And he said, well, I understand that you're all a little surprised, me coming out here with this permanent tan, as he called it. And that just broke the ice for him. He started singing for them. And by the time he was done with that song, everybody was okay. There were still some radio stations that when they found out he was black said, well, we're getting rid of, we won't play his stuff. And Farron Young would tell them, if you take Charlie Pride's records off, then you got to take mine off too. And that helps cement that friendship.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There were people who had trouble with Charlie Pride when he sang about an angel with golden hair, because obviously that implied that he was in love with a white woman.
That's right. Curly Putman's song, Green, Green Grass of Home, has a line, you know, hair of gold. And just as Charlie says, just that one line is he singing a love song to a woman with hair of gold. And they wouldn't allow him to sing that song.
He seems to have handled all that with such grace. Frankly, grace that the audiences and the record companies who at first prejudged him didn't deserve.
I think you're right. I mean, I think there's an interesting comparison to be made between Charlie Pride and Jackie Robinson and the things that they faced and how they faced it, both in terms of overwhelming things with their just sheer, unmistakable, undeniable talent, but also how they carried themselves at that moment in our history to be pathfinders. And so he's, you know, in our interview you could tell that the it's not like the pain and the memory of that pain goes entirely away, but that's just part of his personality, as was with Jackie Robinson. Very fierce people and ambitious people and talented people, but also wanting to make their mark and deciding the best way that they thought they could do that.
Did women in country music, were they always appreciated for their contributions, or did they have to sort of fight their way to equal billing?
That's a great question. You know, women are there from the very beginning. We start our narrative, our storytelling, in the 1920s with Jimmie Rodgers and with the Carter family. And two-thirds of the Carter family are women. And, you know, Maybelle is foundational for guitar picking in this country across genres. Dwayne Allman, you know, used Maybelle as a way to teach his wife how to play the guitar, used her guitar picking style. And Sarah Carter's voice, as Marty Stewart says, you know, anybody, any woman of the current moment needs to know Sarah's voice because that's where she came from. So women are there from the beginning, and they're there in every generation. I would say, yes, they did have to fight their way in, especially as the story really picks up. You know, you have Maddox Brothers and Rose in the 1930s and 1940s, and then you get to Kitty Wells, and then you start to get to Patsy Cline and in the 50s and 60s, and women are supporting each other as they come into the industry. They're coming in on their own. They're not necessarily with their families or with a husband, and they want to be headliners. And we have this great little sequence of, and Jeannie Seely, a singer from that time, tells the story of, you know, we're always introduced as the pretty little gal and make her feel welcome, the connotation being that she's not really welcome, but make her feel that way. And Connie Smith tells this wonderful story about when she came to Nashville. She was at the Opry, and Loretta Lynn said to Doolittle, her husband, go get Connie. I want to talk to her. And they met. And Loretta said, okay, I'm going to do for you what Patsy did for me. And she proceeded to tell her who to watch out for. I think we all know what that probably means, what to expect, you know, and listen. And we found that over and over again, women doing that for each other, particularly through the 60s and 70s, as they came into the industry on their own, trying to make it on their own.
And Loretta, you know, Loretta Lynn is... I hope that our film will make clear is one of the great songwriters in country music history, as is Dolly Parton as well, I might add. But with Loretta, she was not breaking through as a singer, and her producer, Owen Bradley, finally said, well, go back to the way you started. You were writing songs for your kids, you know, just of your own, from your own experiences. And so she did, and she comes out with Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' with Lovin' On Your Mind. And that song in the 1960s, that's a feminist shout, right? It's like, don't come, it's about alcoholism, it's about spousal abuse, it's about a woman's right to her own body. And she's doing it in country music, and as Elvis Costello, one of our commentators, says, nobody in rock and roll or anything are even coming close to touching that kind of topic.
My guests are writer-producer Dayton Duncan and producer Julie Dunphy of the 8-part PBS documentary series Country Music that premieres on September 15th. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That, of course, is Loretta Lynn singing Coal Miner's Daughter in 1969. My guests this hour are the team behind the 8-part documentary series Country Music, a film by Ken Burns that premieres September 15th on PBS. Julie Dunphy is a producer. Dayton Duncan is a writer and producer. Let's go first on the line to LaDonna in Austin. Hi, LaDonna.
Hi, I'm so excited for this documentary. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering how current day the documentary can go. There seems to be a lot of new changes in the country music scene with, like, country trap songs and new groups like the High Women trying to get exposure for women in country music, and I'm just curious how they can address that.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for that question, because it's an important point for us as we promote this film. We are historians, or we're not. We make historical documentaries. We're not journalists, and the difference between those two things is usually about a generation or more's distance from the topic. So we end our film in the mid-1990s. Garth Brooks has taken off, and country music's reaching new levels of popularity. Bill Monroe dies, and the legacy that he leaves is something that has an impact on Marty Stewart and Ricky Skaggs, and also harkens to, you know, country music remembering its roots. And Johnny Cash had been given up as a has-been, dropped unceremoniously from his label, and he's brought back into a studio by a hip-hop producer, of all things, Rick Rubin, and starts recording albums with just himself, his guitar, his remarkable voice, and songs that he wanted to sing, and shows the record labels wrong by winning awards and then doing selling lots of records. And then having got to that point, which is the mid-1960s, we also then take him across into the 21st century when he dies in 2003. But so if you're looking for a discussion, it's basically, that's why we ended it, because we need that space, because you don't know right now. Everyone would have an opinion, but it'd just be an opinion. You won't have that considered judgment, which still might be a bit of an opinion. But who was influential now? You won't know who was influential to the future until you've reached that moment. And that's about in 20 years, someone can make a documentary film or add to ours and be able to make a judgment of what was going on in the start of the 21st century. I will tell you this, though, LaDonna. I mean, so many of the issues that face country music today, our film will show, have been faced all along the way. You know, what is country music? There's always been discussions, arguments, and what our film tries to say is that it's always been many things, not just one thing, but people who are passionate about their corner of it really say the rest of it's not country. We're the only ones that have country. The power of the radio is part of ours. The role of women is part of ours. And today, you know, a number of very strong, great women are facing some of the things that women in the past did. And we won't know for another 20, for a while, how that finally shakes out. In 1962, Ray Charles, an African-American, well-respected, star-making rhythm and blues singer, decided that he finally got the opportunity to make an album solely of his own choosing. And what did he do? He made an album called Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music. He wanted to sing country songs because he grew up listening to the Grand Ole Opry, because he loved the stories. And as Vince Gill says, that album of his was more important to country music than it was for Ray Charles, because it showed how soulful the music could be. So just think back, an African-American singer from some genre not considered country comes in and does a country song, it becomes a sales sensation. Does that ring any bells with you today? Of course it does. And the arguments that come about because of that, that's been with us all the time. But we don't tell those stories because that's journalism and not history.
You know, LaDonna, it's funny because often on these big projects that we've been working on for years, we lift up our heads and look around at the end of it and say, oh, there are all these echoes in the current moment. And I think that's exactly what happened to us with this on issues of race and gender and what is country music. Mark Twain is reported to have said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
So I'm going to press you both. What about Old Town Road, which is what we've sort of been dancing around? Country, not country?
Well, yeah, it's country. It gets into this thing. Well, I think the point of our film is that, you listen to a concerto by Bach and you could probably say, well, that ain't country. But in terms of that particular song, it's just as country as, as you want it to be. You know, if you're looking to try to draw the fences in and the drawbridge over the moat up, then you might be able to make an argument that it's not. But the whole, was Western swing country, right?
Yeah.
You could find people, when Ricky Skaggs decided to put electric guitars and drums to a Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs song or to a Bill Monroe song, was that country? You know, I mean, it's just, I think we get sometimes hung up trying to over categorize things. They're helpful, right? And it's natural for some people. That's how our minds work. And for commercial purposes, certainly, they really want to do that. You know, in the early goings, the black, so-called black music was called, quote, race music. And the white music, they're all, both are coming from the same sources, was, quote, hillbilly music. Well, there's two things about that, presumptions about it. One is that only African Americans are listening to race music and only white people are creating and listening to the hillbilly music. And that wasn't true. And the other thing that that shows you is that the presumption of most of the people in society was this is music from people that are beneath us. And part of our the story
in
of,
both cases, right?
On both sides cases, of it. Yeah. Absolutely. And so they had this commonality as well in the musical roots of them. So, you know, it's interesting always. And we cover that, you know, throughout our series. But you, generally what you find is the when it really gets kind of vicious and exclusionary, it misses the point that it's music that, that is trying to bring us all together, that that it comes from these roots and it has this commonality. And sit back and enjoy it. You know, it's a great song.
Let the fans decide.
Yeah.
All right, I want to go back to the phones now. Our number is 800-933-5372. Jean is on the line in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Jean.
Oh, hi, Chris. Thank you for this topic. And you guys were actually talking about something that I wanted to bring up. I actually participated in an event several years ago. It was called the Ambassadors Forum. And one of the event sponsors was Charlie Pride. And he and his wife hosted a private dinner for ambassadors from all over the world in their home. And what was interesting is they were clearly fans of Mr. Pride, and there was so much reverence in the room. But one of the things that they wanted, and he'd actually stipulated this as being a host, is that he would not sing. And even though they implored him to do so throughout the evening, he was very cordial, but he said that was just the one thing he wouldn't do. And I got the impression, and I've heard this about previous individuals of color, is that they oftentimes felt like they were on display or, for lack of a better term, being treated as the dog and pony show. And I felt like he just didn't want to do that in his private home. And I just wanted to get your guest thoughts on if they've heard those kinds of things about other artists of color, particularly Mr. Pride. And I'll take my response off the air.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I know stories of lots of different country stars who of either race who, you know, it's at functions like that, you know, that this is what they do for a living. And you want to say, this is a, you know, and I've got to do it here too. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I would be the last person on earth to try to speak for Charlie Pride. I have such great admiration for him, both as an artist and as a human being. But I imagine you're probably onto something, is that, you know, they were there gathered at his home, you know, not to hear him sing one of his top 10 hits or look at the, you know, gold albums on his walls, but because he is a tremendous human being and gracious and was hosting these people there, you know, that'd be my own guess.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Going back to the origins of country music, it reminds us really that there was a time before recorded music was everywhere when if you wanted music to be part of your life, you had to learn how to play. And it wasn't necessarily that everybody was gifted, but everybody probably played an instrument. Have we lost something in that so, relatively speaking, so few of us do music anymore? We consume a lot of music, but we think it's best left to the professionals.
Boy, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I grew up at a time when, you know, you could turn on a radio, an AM. There was an FM. I'm that old. But my mom played the piano, and I was forced to take piano lessons and grew to like playing the piano. And then I sang in church choirs and picked up a guitar and sang in the two folk groups when I was in high school. So music was an important part of my life. And the listening to music on the radio and on records help fuel it and not discourage it. But I think, but I do think that you're probably right in this, is that in the origins of the, of these this music, the place you would hear it would be in your home, or out on your porch, or out in the work field, or in church, or you might go to a minstrel show, or a medicine man would come through town. He'd always have music to help draw the crowd so he could hawk his snake oil. And our film traces that moment when all that is about to change because of this brand new thing called radio, and because of the record industry catching up and saying, oh, well, this is maybe there's money to be made recording these hill country type things. And so if you're reliant on how are you going to pass the evening, right, and you don't have a choice of TV or live streaming or listening to music, but those choices are, do we read poetry to one another? Do we do amateur theatrical scenes? Or does, you know, Aunt Betty get out the banjo and Uncle Billy his fiddle and they do that and we all sing some old songs together? I mean, I suppose that ineluctably would cut back on how much music is actually happening in people's homes these days.
Was there a golden era of country music? Was there a time when it was that, you know, we're always asking this question, when did something reach its apex, and have we passed that time, or is that time still in the future?
I don't think, everybody's, usually the golden era for anybody is, in their view, is if you're talking about the golden era of your profession, it was when you were young and doing
right.
it, right? And then everything went to hell.
Right.
Or the golden era of culture was when you were 18 or 19 or 22 or something like that. And so things will keep changing. For me, the two very big eras would have been in the 60s and then in the mid-70s. And again, that's probably a reflection of my age. But particularly in the 70s, when you had Waylon and Willie and the Outlaws, you also had Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark and a bunch of other people who were focused on their art versus their commercial value. You had, as much as some people would not like, the country-politan sound, the very smooth sound. You had George Jones singing He Stopped Loving Her Today, which is just a terrific song and is as country-politan as you can get. Emmylou Harris has burst onto the scene, fusing folk and rock with country music and her own interpretations of classic songs. Dolly Parton breaks from Porter Wagner's show. She's no longer the pretty little girl singer. She's a singer-songwriter in her own right. She writes and records Jolene, which is just like one of the great songs ever. We tell the story of how she came to write I Will Always Love You, which most people associate with Whitney Houston. But she wrote that song, Dolly did, to convince Porter Wagner that she needed to leave his show and go out on her own. I mean, there's really good stuff going on in that. And country music then, for a while at least, opened its arms to more types of music.
16 hours of those stories in the upcoming documentary Country Music, a film by Ken Burns, which premieres September 15th on PBS. Writer-producer Dayton Duncan and producer Julie Dunphy are my guests today and worked on the film. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's been fun.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.